This Sunday, I'm giving two different messages. They will be connected to each other, both dealing but different ways with this whole issue of, is faith actually delusional, or is faith really blind? And then on Wednesday, we will have the opportunity to ask questions. Let me just say just a few things about Wednesday. I'll be asking, if you are there, then you will have the opportunity to write down questions or whatever it is. If you are going to email questions in or text questions in, I'm going to ask the church on a separate piece of paper to print out every single question that comes. The reason being that I think when people often come to these events, they often think that's going to be set up in some way. And so the way I normally do this is we will gather all of the questions together. There will be no filtering. There will be no, you know, discarding ones aside or anything like that. They will be printed out. Okay? And then they will just be drawn from either a hat or a basket or a whatever it is that is required to put all those pieces of paper in. Okay? And as the questions come out, we will deal with them. It's just to say, if you are thinking of asking a question, you have an equal opportunity to have your question answered or indeed not answered as everybody else. So there will be no, as I say, you know, this will not be set up in any way, and this will not be controlled in any other way, apart from the fact that whatever questions get selected out of the hat as they come, those are the ones that will be answered. So if you have people who you think would appreciate that, or indeed you just like playing the lottery, even though you shouldn't, then you know, here's a chance for you to see something done in a different way. And I will do everything I possibly can to get through as many questions during that evening as time permits, and indeed as there are actually people in the room. We may just preach the place empty. Now, what I'm going to do this morning is I would like to take three areas in which people feel or think that the Christian faith has failed and therefore, in that sense, is actually blind. Now, one of these arguments is more philosophical. As a matter of fact, the title they have selected for me for this day is quite philosophical, so you're going to get two bunches of that twice. So in that sense, if all happiness has gone by the end of today, you'll understand why. We'll take one this morning. We'll take, I say, three different areas. One is more philosophical. The argument is that faith is blind by nature, by very definition, because it is a faith. That is what makes it blind. That's why we believe things by faith, because there is no other way of believing them. And therefore, so the first critique that we'll deal with is this is actually blind by nature. Now, the second angle that we will take is that this is actually blind in terms of its outworking, in terms of its historical view. In other words, if you look at the church as it spread throughout history, you'll see that it's done many, many terrible things. In that sense, it can neither be believed nor trusted. You'd have to be crazy, indeed blind. You have to shut your eyes to everything that's gone past, gone before, all the terrible things that have been done in the name of the Christian faith in order to make yourself somehow part of this Christian community. And the third thing that we're going to look at will then be actually an argument which is slightly more subtle, but it is that the Christian faith is actually morally blind. In other words, Christians seem to believe that that the values that they hold, that what they actually think about, in particular the character and nature of God, is something worshipful, that God is to be worshipped, that he is a morally beautiful, magnificent, incredible being. Whereas, of course, most atheists would argue that actually God, and certainly the God of the Bible, is actually morally abhorrent, that there is actually no one worse than him. And we will look at that, especially in the criticism that comes from many of the so-called new atheists, although that title is now actually becoming slightly old, but a current crop of very vocal atheists who basically say that the very nature of God means that if you want to believe in him, you're simply fooling yourself, certainly as it is revealed in the Bible. And we will touch in relationship to that question, in relationship to judgment. Okay, why is it that if this faith is so wonderful, if that what you believe is so great and it's all about love anyway, why can't I just get on with my life, do whatever I want to? Why does this God actually want me to worship him? And why does it seem that this God of the Bible is so interested in judgment? Now, in the evening, we're going to take a slightly different approach, and we will deal slightly more directly with some of the more, if you like, scientific objections, which they are to the Christian faith, what it means to be a Christian, and I may also share something of my own Christian journey. Now, let's just therefore take each of these areas, and really this talk is not going to take me any more than 2.5 hours to give, so we'll be finished in good time for the afternoon. So let's first of all just deal with this first issue, this more philosophical issue, and this is very early in the morning to be thinking about such complex and difficult questions. I almost didn't go into the Christian ministry because Christians seem to love having prayer breakfast and things early in the morning, and God didn't design me that way. He designed me to stay up late at night. And so, but early in the morning, let's just try to address this particular question. Now, the main criticism comes from this. Look, the Christian faith is not true or real. It has nothing to do with truth or reality. That's why it is faith. That's why you need faith to believe it. Okay, faith is the art of believing in things that are not there. When I first became a Christian, people would sometimes say to me things like, Michael, I'm so happy that you're a Christian. I wish I could believe what you believe, but I can't. Now, I can remember after hearing this in the fourth or fifth different country in a row, when I first started doing what I'm doing, which is traveling around the world answering people's questions, I thought, why is it that this question, this comment is so universal? Why am I finding it in so many different countries, so many different cultures? So I began thinking about what it was they were actually saying. Do you want me to speak a bit faster, by the way, so that we get through the message quicker? We can up the tempos very slightly if you would prefer. So, up comes this question. I'm so happy for you. I wish I could believe what you believe, but I can't. Now, as I reflected on this, what they were basically saying is, look, Michael, I wish I could be happy in the way that you seem to be. And the way that you talk about your relationship with God, it obviously makes you very, very happy. Okay, but the reason that you are happy, the reason why you have this joy, as we've heard about this morning, is because you believe in Jesus, but he doesn't exist. Now, what do you call people who believe in things that are not there? The answer is mad people. So what they are saying is, Michael, you are insane. But the main thing is that you are happy and insane. I am happy that you are happy. As a matter of fact, I'm so desperate to be happy myself, I too would embrace insanity just to join you. I've thought about it, I'd love to do it, but I just can't. Now, this makes a huge issue about the word faith and how we understand it. Now, the Bible does say that faith is a gift, but it is not the gift of stupidity. It's not the gift that allows you to believe in things that you wish existed but didn't. Okay, that would be the gift of wishful thinking. And so here we have, right at the very beginning, a huge problem with how we understand the word faith, what the word faith actually means. Now, despite the fact that very popular authors like Dan Brown and various others have defined faith as believing in things, okay, which either go against the evidence or believing things in the absence of evidence, that is simply not a position that could be defended either historically from the teaching of the church or biblically from the teaching of Scripture. Neither of those two will allow you to come to such a definition of faith. Okay, so what is faith? Now, I know we're going to be talking about definitions at this point, so please, please do forgive me. I love dictionaries. Those of you who heard me speak before will know I have a deep love for dictionaries. I have probably almost 50 dictionaries in my study back in Oxford. They are just the most amazing thing. I don't know if you've ever tried reading one. Okay, the plot is not very exciting, but it does explain every word as you go through. Now, so how do we understand this word faith then, especially as we approach it simply from a dictionary definitional point of view? Now, obviously, dictionaries do make mistakes. I can remember being in Oxford on the bus, and I found myself sitting next to a gentleman. I've often sat on the same bus going in and out of town with him. He goes to the church that I go to in Oxford. Very unassuming-looking man, a very plain, straightforward-looking man. I had no idea what he did. And he never really said very much. He didn't speak very much. And so it was hard to form an opinion on him, apart from the fact that he looked very, very quiet. And as far as I could tell, you know, I had no idea what he was up to. It never really occurred to me. One day I saw him on the bus. I went and sat next to him. And I said, Andrew, I said, you know, I often see you on this bus. And at church, I said, what do you do? And he is actually one of course, this being Oxford, someone who has multiple PhDs, speaks four different languages, and writes for the Oxford English Dictionary. And then I said, gosh, that's a huge volume. I said, what piece of work? I actually have the Oxford English Dictionary. I've got the 20-volume series. They just come out with a new 26-volume series, so I'm now feeling slightly inferior. But for a brief, shining moment, I did have the state-of-the-art dictionary. And I just said to him, there are so many entries in there, you must make mistakes from time to time. And he just very quietly said, well, yes. So I said, well, could you give me an example of a mistake that has been made that you felt was sort of embarrassing? And he said, well, one year we misspelt the word illiterate. I said, and I laughed, I said, what a word to get wrong. I said, now, as you probably know, there's also a dictionary that's published out of Cambridge. I said, I assume there's a big rivalry between Oxford and Cambridge. I said, tell me, I guess the Cambridge English Dictionary, do they like send you a fax with the error, with the big circle around it, or make fun of you in some way, or something like that? And again, he's a very quiet man. He just went, no. So I said, well, why not? He said, well, that year they misspelt the word misspelt. But I would just like to say that I have checked these definitions, and they are, these are inherently reliable. The word faith, as we have it in the English language today, as it is commonly assumed, okay, is problematic. Although there is a remnant of the true definition of what this word actually means, even in our present-day language, which I'll give you in a minute. But historically, if you were to pick up a Middle English dictionary, or dictionary written before then, or even actually dictionaries written just after the Middle English, or if you were indeed to pick up a decent research dictionary, just the modern Oxford English dictionary, look up the word faith, you will see that the word faith is very much connected to the ideas of truth and reality. It carries with it the idea of trust, as to being morally persuaded to someone or something that you can put your trust, your weight on them. Faith is not therefore believing in what you wish to be true. Now, we still use this in modern English when we talk about having someone put their faith in us. Can you trust this person? You're asking, can I put my faith in them? Can I put my trust in them? You're asking two questions. Number one, are they actually real? Is there an authenticity to this person, a reality to this person, which makes them dependable? And number two, are they true to their word? If they say something, do they do it? Do they keep their promises? Faith, even therefore in this modern sense, is always a response to truth and reality. Is this true? Is this real? Can it be depended upon? Faith is therefore always justified by her object. What have you put your faith in? And that object must be both real, stable, and solid, and it must be true. It must have structure. It must have integrity. Which is why we talk about faithfulness, or someone breaking faith with us, which means that they basically stabbed us in the back or betrayed us in some way. The reason why we use this inherently moral language is because the very nature of putting your faith or trust in someone is something which is to do very deeply with authenticity, reality, truth. As a matter of fact, all morality actually is also connected to this as well, which is why we talk about people lying to us or deceiving to us or misleading us. All of those statements are statements which require something as to truth, a statement of truth and reality, married together with some kind of moral value. And that is exactly how the word faith is used in the Bible. Now, in the Old Testament, you cannot properly find the noun faith in the sense that in the Hebrew language that the Old Testament was written in, there is no noun faith. So you cannot have a faith, the faith. Okay? There is the concept of faithfulness, okay, which we actually sometimes translate in the Old Testament as the righteous are justified by faith because of the way the Greek renders it, but that's a whole other debate we don't need to get into. But it doesn't actually cause any problem for us. Within the Hebrew language, there was not a noun, a faith, the faith, but there was the action of putting your weight or trust into something which is true or real. In the language of the New Testament, okay, the Gospels, the Epistles, okay, what the Apostle Paul wrote, when they used the word faith, they actually had two options available to them. One of the words comes from nomos, nomizo. It means to believe something by law or custom. Whenever you read an English translation of the Bible, the word faith is never translated out of that particular word. Every time you read your English translation, regardless of who translated it, and you see the word faith, it's always a translation of the word pistis, which comes from the verb pito, which means to be persuaded. And it carries exactly the same force of meaning, that you are persuaded that something is true and real, and therefore you can put your weight in it. That's why in Hebrews 11:6 it says, without faith it is impossible to please God. Okay, without faith, it is impossible to please God. That means if you want to please God, you need to have faith, in which case you need to know what faith is. And actually, very handily, Hebrews 11:6 defines what faith is. Without faith, it is impossible to please God, and faith is. Knowing that he is. Knowing that God exists. Knowing that. That is a statement about reality. God is. Not that you want him to be, you wish him to be, or you hope him to be. Okay, but that he is. And secondly, that he rewards those who diligently seek him. In other words, he is completely true to his word. If he promises you one thing, he will give it. You can totally, utterly, and completely rely on his promises. That is what we mean when we talk about faith. Strong faith, therefore, is not believing things which you suspect aren't true. Because if that is correct, the strongest type of faith you could have would be knowing something isn't true and still able to believe it. Which would be an amazing feat. Strong faith is born out of a response. to a God who is there and to a God who is true. The stronger your faith is in direct relation to the reality of God that you know and the truth, the trustworthiness of his promises and his words that you come to. The more you are convinced of that, the more that God is, the more sure you are of that, the more persuaded you are of that, and the more you know that you can trust what he says, the stronger your faith, even when you don't know what is happening to you. Which is why, even when we find ourselves caught up in difficult situations like cancer, illness, where things are happening which we may not completely understand, where we fail to find an answer, why me? We're still able to trust him because he is there and because he is true. Do you know that kind of faith? Do you have that kind of faith in your life? You know, it's very, very interesting. I sometimes meet people who say to me, look, I think I've lost my faith. Now, the question is, well, when did you know him? If you've lost something, you once had it. You cannot lose something you never had. So my question is, when did you know that God is real and that he was true? When did you put your complete trust in him? When did you know him, have a relationship with him? Now, it's interesting to me, the number of people who come and say, I have lost my faith, what they're actually saying is, I am losing my idea of God. I had these ideas about God, they're being taken away from me. I had these thoughts about God, I'm not sure I can trust them anymore. I had these, like, wish feelings connected to God, they're simply not around anymore. But you need to understand, in that sense, you're not losing faith biblically. It just means that your ideas about God, your thoughts about God, your speculations about God, your wishes about God are being exposed either to be bankrupt or unfounded. But that's not the same as losing faith. You cannot lose what you never had. I cannot lose relationship with my wife unless I first had one with her. Do you know him? Do you have a relationship with him? Are you intimate with him? Do you trust him? Now, if you know him, there are all kinds of questions that may then come from that. God, why do you do this and not that? What about this? How do I understand that? But you cannot lose what you never had. If you're here this morning and you are skeptical or unsure, my question to you is this. Have you ever known him? Have you ever had that communion, that intimacy, relationship with him? Or was it just the question that you knew about him? You've speculated from afar, you've thought from afar, and now that is being questioned. Well, I don't have any trouble with that being questioned. It may be the path to actually truly finding out what it is to know him. The Christian claim, the central Christian claim, is that there is a God who knows you and loves you and is desirous of relationship with you. He doesn't want you to believe in him in the sense of have ideas about him. He wants you to believe in him in the same way that my wife wants me to believe in her. To know him in the same way that my wife wants me to know her. It's very interesting if you read, you know, the older translations of the Bible where Adam knew Eve and then she fell pregnant. That suggests they did more than exchange CVs and email addresses. If you're confused on that point, come and speak to one of the pastors here. They'll explain with diagrams how the process works. There is a knowing that is based in reality, but it also is desirous of intimacy. These are not conflicting. This is not saying it is subjective. Just means that it's meant to be intimate, even though it is real. Do you know him? Jesus Christ is claiming to be God. He's claiming to come into this world to make it possible for us to enter into that relationship with him. Yes, to answer the questions we have about him, but also to know him. Now, claiming to be God is no small thing. Anyone can actually claim to be God. It's not actually that difficult. I don't know if you know the story of a psychiatrist who went to a psychiatric wing, just been moved to a new wing of the hospital. Comes to the first bed, he's getting to know his patients, he looks into the bed, he says to the first guy, who are you? The guy says, I am Napoleon. The psychiatrist says, that's fascinating, who told you that? He said, God told me. And the guy in the bed next to him said, I did not. It is not problematic to make a claim to be God. Anyone can do it. What is problematic is meaningfully sustaining it. That is what is difficult. How do you know it is possible to meet him? I mean, if you walked out of this room, and as you walked out of the door, back towards your car, you suddenly found yourself floating off the floor. And you feel this warm glow and a voice speaking in your head saying, this is God, believe in me. How do you know this room is not being filled with hallucinogenic gas that inclines people to these kinds of mystical experiences? I mean, how would you know that? It is hard for God to reveal himself meaningfully, harder than we may think. If we're willing to simply accept him, then yes, of course, he can come to us in any way. Part of the Christian claim is that God has revealed himself in history through fulfilled prophecy, through the resurrection, through historical events which are critically examinable. Have you ever looked into them? Now, some people say, well, Jesus was a very clever man. He lived his life to fulfill all of these prophecies about him. But many of these prophecies concern where he would be born and who his parents would be. That's something very hard to control on the other side of the womb. There's an Alpha course which is starting up here, which is designed precisely to allow people to look into these kinds of questions. There are little slips of it on your piece of paper. Okay, I'm not on commission. Right? I just want to make that abundantly clear. Why not fill it out and go along to the first one or two? It's an opportunity to find out more. Is this true? Is this real? Is there a basis to this? Okay, there will be atheists there and agnostics there and Christians who aren't sure what they believe. Okay, and Christians who have just become Christians who want to find out more about what they believe and various others as well. Some of them will be normal. The whole group will not be normal, partly because some of you will be there. Why not go along and find out? This is not a brainwashing event. This is an event to allow you to ask questions and to come to know the truth that Christ says that all people can come to know. Do you know him? I have a good friend, J. John Anderson. He was here a couple of months ago. We both have Greek Cypriot mothers, and so we know each other fairly well, and we meet together every so often, several times a year, to have some fun together. And after he became a Christian, his mother said to him, John, you've been brainwashed. He looked at his mother and said, Mother, if you knew what was in my brain, you'd be glad it's been washed. This is not something which is designed to make you believe something that isn't true. This is to give you the opportunity to find out if it is true. The kind of cleansing that comes is of a totally different order, and we're going to end up on that point. Faith is not delusional by definition or by nature, as some people have made it out to be. Wherever the Christian faith has taken root and grown, wherever there has been revival, three things always follow in its wake. Firstly, historically, you'll see that hospices are built to care for the poor, the sick, and the dying. Two, there is always an explosion of creative art, which is a shame given the fact that in many of our so-called awakenings that in many cases hasn't happened ever since, well, there are cultural reasons for that, but let's not get into it. But it should be the case, an explosion of creativity. And three, the establishment of universities. Why universities? Well, because they are the setting in which critical, difficult questions are asked. So Oxford University, where I have the privilege to occasionally teach and be part of in some small way, its motto is Dominus Illuminatio Mea, the Lord is my light. Because it was founded by Christians' pursuit on the truth, and if you have the truth, you're not scared of difficult questions. You welcome them. You do not welcome questions if you are lying or trying to deceive people, but if you stand in what you believe to be true and real, you welcome questions. Why not come along to Alpha and ask them? Okay? These church leaders are being paid. They're not being paid out of taxes. They're being paid by other people. So if you're not a Christian here, make them work for their money. This is not going to cost you anything, at least up until the point of commitment, but that's something else. Secondly, let's just deal with this second side, which is a slightly more existential type of question, where people feel the Christian faith has failed, and therefore, in that sense, it's delusional. Okay? It's blind. You have to close your eyes. And that's to do with the history of the church. Just look at how terrible it has been throughout history. Awful things it has done. Terrible things done in the name of the Christian faith. Wars, fights, and so on. Well, let me just say two things just to help set this up. I can remember being on BBC TV now many, many years ago with a key person from the Secular Society and a key person from the Humanist Society. And people were phoning in with their questions, and we had to try and respond to their questions. And the two people who were interviewing us also chipped in with their own questions. And at one point, one of them leant over and looked at me and said, what about all the wars that are in the name of the Christian faith? What about them? So my first response was to ask a question. Well, what about all the wars done in the name of the Christian faith? Now, this was quite a long time ago, ladies and gentlemen. A guy called Saddam Hussein was still alive. There was another war going on. These wars never seem to be never ending these days. So I just looked at the presenter and I said, look, Saddam Hussein claims to be the president of the Democratic Republic of Iraq. Let's suppose we were talking about democracy today, and you said to me, I hate democracy. Democracy is a terrible thing. Look at the terrible thing it does to it, people. Look at Saddam Hussein. Look at Iraq. I want nothing to do with democracy. I would have to look at you and say, yes, but that's not democratic. Similarly, there are many things which are done in the name of the Christian faith which are simply not Christian. Just because you do something in the name of something doesn't mean that it is. And there are many things done in the name of the Christian faith which are simply not Christian. Now, interestingly enough, the Bible itself actually gives us a litmus test. One of the earliest books of the New Testament is the book of Galatians. Not sure exactly when it was written. Okay, somewhere between, let's say, AD 48, AD 51. I mean, very, very, very early on. It's one of the earliest pieces of Christian literature that we have in the Bible. Now, in that book, the author of that book has two concerns. One, what is the true gospel? What is the true good news? What is it that Christians actually believe? And two, how do you tell a true Christian from a false one? And he gives us a litmus test. And he gives us a litmus test to try to find out, how do we know if this is true or not? And in one point in this book, he says, look, if someone says they are a Christian, they should have the fruit of the Spirit in them. Now, that word fruit is in the singular, just a fruit. But the flavor, we are told, is complex. Is we are told that this fruit should taste of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, self-control, goodness, patience, and so on. Okay, that's what this fruit should taste like. So it's interesting, the Apostle Paul, here writing to the early church, is basically saying to them, bite me. But in a very nice way. He's saying, look, I'm not asking you to simply trust me that I'm a Christian because I'm telling you. You should see this evidence in my life. This is the fruit you should taste. However, he says, if you taste hatred, malice, anger, lust, and so on, if that's what you taste when you try this fruit, then you have every right, and indeed, some would say the responsibility, to question the reality of what has been claimed. Now, I love the church. Ever since I became a Christian, I just fell immediately in love with the church. And the church is my family. Sometimes they do things which are wrong. I want to know their names and addresses. I will go and visit them, and we will talk with them. But there are two things going on here. Number one, at times people are claiming to be Christians when they are not. If you have been put off by a counterfeit Christian faith, something that is Christian in name only, but not in reality, then I do want to apologize for all of the hurt that you have done. But we need to call this for what it is. It is not Christian. Now, on the other hand, you may well have encountered genuine Christians. And you found that they're not perfect. I am not perfect. But there's another aspect to this fruit that should tell you about the genuineness of what's going on, and it's this. Are they willing to say sorry when they get it wrong? When's the last time someone apologized to you at work? In school? A neighbor? Christians are aware of the fact that we are held to the highest moral standard you could possibly be held to. And when we get it wrong, one of the signs of the reality of what is going on is the willingness to say sorry. Because that's how you keep relationships intact. And as I said in my first point, the Christian faith is inherently relational. Steve, who was introducing me this morning, you know, let's supposing, I don't know, that I come down on this platform and he and I start having an animated discussion. Okay? I start screaming at him. Eventually, I push him down in the seat, I put my foot on his up to his neck, and I look at him and I say, you're a stupid man. You have the intellectual capacity more commonly associated with forms of pond life which are invisible to the naked eye. Now, let's supposing I say this, and bizarrely, he takes that as being insulting. And let's supposing you see me doing this to him. On Wednesday, you come with your question, but your question isn't like all the other questions. What about science? You know, what about this? What about that? How can you be so sure? Your question isn't like that at all. Your question is, Michael, I saw you talking to Steve at the end of the service on Sunday. How are things between you and him right now? And I look at you and I say, they've never been better. We've never been so close to each other in our whole life. As a matter of fact, he's become one of my closest friends. Now, what kind of person would you think I am? For most of you, far too polite to use the words that you would use to normally describe someone who acts in that way. I mean, you would have to have the emotional intelligence factor of zero to come to that conclusion, right? I mean, what kind of bigoted, arrogant, self-centered, narcissistic person would you have to be to think that after what had happened on Sunday night, that we somehow enjoyed a close, intimate relationship? But there's only one set of circumstances under which that statement of mine could actually be true. Let's suppose after everyone has left here today, he takes me out, he talks to me. He extends grace and forgiveness to me. He says, Michael, I have no. Why did you speak to me that way? And as I speak to him, I suddenly realize how wrong I was. And I say, Steve, what I did to you was terrible this morning. It was completely unjustified. I was wrong. I'm so sorry. Will you forgive me? And he forgives me, and we talk, and we spend all night. We're up until 2 o'clock in the morning talking to each other. And when you come and see me on Wednesday, and you say, how's the things between you and Steve? And I say, we've never been closer. And this is now one of the most meaningful relationships I have. I am speaking the complete truth. There's not a word of arrogance in it or presumption. Use of the word sorry is how you keep relationships intact. And by the way, for all you men out there, that's not saying, sorry, I hurt your feelings. That's no apology at all. That's saying, I'm right, but you are very sensitive. You have no idea how many marriages get into trouble that way, so please listen carefully. Christian repentance, saying sorry, is born out of a conviction of being wrong. I was wrong. That's why we're sorry. We're not sorry that someone else's feelings got hurt. We're not even sorry that our feelings have been hurt. That's called feeling sorry for yourself. Or feeling sorry that someone else is feeling sorry for themselves. It's born out of a sense that something has been done which is wrong. It has to be acknowledged as having been wrong. Saying sorry is a way of acknowledging that I was wrong, and a way of receiving the other person's forgiveness and re-entering into relationship with them. It's true in marriage, and it's most certainly true of God. Look for Christians who are willing to apologize. They're serious about keeping their relationship with God on track, and they're willing to come to you and tell you when they were out of order. Look for that fruit. We're not perfect, but we are forgiven. And we know what it means to be forgiven. There are many terrible things done in the name of the Christian faith down through the centuries. I can't excuse any of them. No one should be blind to it. To be ignorant of history is to repeat its mistakes, as many people have said. But please don't confuse some of what happened with that history with the reality of what it means to know Christ. This is not blind. Thirdly, very quickly. Maybe I shouldn't have said quickly, that could be a lie. Let's see if it's quick or not. Moral. A moral blindness. Now, there are millions of ways of dealing with this. One could be to look at a world filled with suffering and say, how can you be so blind as to the moral evils that are happening there? You close your eyes and you disbelieve in the face of evidence. But I want to take with it maybe even a slightly deeper question, a more fundamental question, as I said, which is the one which I highlighted at the beginning. Okay, Michael, you've just been talking about relationship just now and love. You even mentioned that in the first point. But the God of the Bible is inherently judgmental. He judges everybody. It's terrible. Look, if this God of your God, if this God of yours is so great, I have two questions for you. One, why doesn't he just accept everybody? I mean, what's wrong with that? You just do the best you can. Everything will work out in the end. Someone's just written a book exactly along these lines. Second one is, look, you Christians, your faith is really in trouble. You say that Jesus Christ came into this world, that he was God, and that he was crucified for our sins. Now, if you pick up any book by Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, and so on, if you're familiar with any of these names, this is one point they all come back to. Indeed, many what are called liberal theologians also come back to this point. This is a very barbaric thing. Look, let's supposing you came to me and offended me, and then you came back and said, Michael, I want to apologize. And I say, look, I'm happy to forgive you, but before I forgive you, I must first sacrifice my only son, James. And when I've killed him, then I will come and forgive you. You would think I was some kind of moral barbarian, wouldn't you? And if someone came along and said, wow, what a glorious picture. Michael is one of the most amazing people I know. You would look at them and say, you're either stupid or you're blind. Maybe both. So are Christians blind when it comes to this whole issue? Well, this is a very, very difficult question, I have to admit. Now, the reason it is difficult is in our culture, we understand, I would like to suggest, not very much about the nature of love in and of itself. So let's just deal with this whole idea of a loving God in the first place. Love is more complex than we think. It's more precious than we think. It's more amazing than we think. And then maybe that's why it's becoming increasingly rare. I don't know how many of you have read Jane Austen's book, Pride and Prejudice. It's a fantastic book to read if you haven't read it. Probably the most famous love story, or one of the most famous love stories ever written in the English language. Now, if you haven't seen it, you may well have seen the BBC 6-part adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. How many of you have seen that? Now, that's a fair number of you. If you've seen it, you'll notice the striking resemblance between myself and Mr. Darcy. Now, that's not funny. Now, this is a love story between a guy called Darcy and a woman called Elizabeth. Darcy falls in love with Elizabeth. He doesn't realize it. Now, it's set back in the times where gentlemen were required to be gentlemen, or expected to be at least. At one point, he walks into a room and finds himself alone with this woman. Protocol demands that he leaves. He cannot be alone, unsupervised, unaccompanied with another woman in the same room. So he turns and he gets halfway out the door. And as he's halfway out the door, he stops. He turns around, he re-enters the room, and he says, "It will not do. My feelings cannot be repressed. You must allow me to tell you how much I ardently admire and love you." Now, gentlemen, listen carefully. That line is a winner. Now, having made this declaration of love, he goes on to explain that he loves her, even though it goes against his will, against his reason, and against his own better character. She rejects that declaration of love and refuses it. Because he is a man, he can't understand why. So he asks for explanation. She looks at him and says, "You told me that you love me even though it went against your will, against your reason, and against your own better character." In other words, she's saying, "You told me you loved me even though it went against all better judgment." True love does not exist in the absence of judgment. True love only exists in the presence of it. The words "I love you" are meaningful to you if the person who speaks them truly knows you. Look, I can promise you right now, if no one knows the real you, if no one knows your weaknesses, your shortcomings, your failings, the darker side of your character, if nobody knows that, even if you're one of the most popular people in this place, I can guarantee that you are desperately lonely. If there are a few people in this world who do know you, your weaknesses, your shortcomings, your failings, and they love you, those are the most meaningful relationships you have. And when anything good happens and when anything terrible happens, they are the first people who you ring up to share it with. Because that's what love is. Love does not exist in the absence of judgment. Love only exists in the presence of it. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the work of a group of very famous contemporary philosophers called the Black Eyed Peas. In one of their treatises called "Where is the Love?", they pen these words: "People killing, people dying, children hurt, you hear them crying. Can you practice what you preach? Would you turn the other cheek? Father, 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 help us. Send us some guidance from above, because people got me questioning, where is the love? I feel the weight of the world on my shoulders. As I'm getting older, people are getting colder. Most of us only care about money making. Selfishness got us following the wrong direction. Wrong information always shown by the media. Negative images are the main criteria. Although in the song it says negative images is the main criteria, but I've corrected the grammar because it's not right. Kids want to act like they see in the cinema. Whatever happened to the values of humanity? Whatever happened to fairness and equality? Instead of spreading love, we're spreading animosity, lack of understanding leading lives away from unity. Now, here's the knockout line. The truth is kept secret. It's swept under the rug. If you've never known truth, then you've never known love. I have no idea whether they wrote this themselves or someone wrote it for them. But they're absolutely right. The truth is kept secret. It's swept under the rug. If you've never known truth, then you've never known love. True love does not exist in the absence of judgment. True love only exists in the presence of it. Love is meaningful when the person who speaks it knows everything about you, and that is precisely the way in which God loves us. God looks into every human heart. And he does see all of the failings and the weaknesses and the shortcomings. He sees all the things that we do wrong. He sees everything. He sees sin. Now, we're actually told in the Bible that God is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in love. Now, that word compassionate, as we have it in the English language, comes from Latin grammar. It comes from ecclesiastical Latin. It comes from the Latin that governs the life of the church. Compassion means, or entails within it, the idea of making a moral judgment about something and being moved to the depth of your being to do something about it. So you have compassion in the face of poverty when you make a moral judgment. You say, that is wrong. And then you're moved to the depth of your being to do something about it. If you're not moved in your being to do something about it, you don't have compassion. You have moralizing. You have compassion in the face of racism when you make an absolute moral judgment. That is wrong. And then you are moved to the depth of your being to do something about it. If you're not moved within your being to do anything about it, you don't have compassion. You have moralizing. God is not interested in moralizing. God is compassionate. He looks into every human heart, sees what is there, and says, that is wrong. And then he is moved to the depth of his being to do something about it. And that is the cross. God himself comes into this world. God himself takes on the price of things that we have done wrong. God himself pays with his own being where we have failed. And both what sin is and all of the consequences of it, he takes on into himself and he deals with it on the cross. He pays. He steps in to rescue. Now the argument, of course, is, but Michael, look, this is just now blind faith. This really is blind faith, because why? If he's so loving and kind, why doesn't he just forgive? Why this moral atrocity at the center of your faith? And the answer is, mercy is difficult for God. It's hard. Whenever you exercise mercy, you always do it at the expense of justice, by definition. Otherwise, you're not being merciful, you're being just. Mercy implies, normally, that the reason you need mercy is that justice says something else should happen. So a judge has mercy. If he looks at someone and says, look, you're guilty, you definitely did it, but look, I'm a kind and forgiving man, I'll let you off. That's how we commonly understand mercy. But that means, therefore, that mercy is always exercised at the expense of God's justice. And indeed, in every faith of the world, mercy is exercised at the expense of God's justice. He sets aside the requirements of justice in order to be merciful. Now, that is true in every religion of the world apart from one. In the Christian faith, God does not set aside his mercy in order to exercise mercy. He exercises mercy through his justice. It's through the justice of the cross, where wrongdoing is punished, where sin is dealt with, that God fulfills all of the requirements of justice and through it to us extends mercy. Which is why if you are a Christian, we talk about justification by faith and not mercification by faith. God upholds and fulfills the requirements of justice. Sin is punished. Guilt is dealt with. It's not swept aside. And through it, to us, he extends mercy. And when we come to a position to repent before him and look to him, we receive that mercy. And we're forgiven. Do you know him? Do you have a relationship with him? Do you trust him? There's just so many other things I could say, but because I'm a merciful man, I won't. I want you to go home so you think nice things about me. Now, we'll be dealing with a different set of questions this evening, but it would be remiss of me this morning if I didn't ask you as we approach noon about where you actually stand with him. A lot of people treat God and think of religion as a forgiveness ATM. So we feel bad about ourselves. And so we come along to church and God is there and we say, God, sorry. And we take the little chit of paper with forgiveness written on it and we go away and now we feel better about ourselves. Until we do the same bad thing again. And then having done the bad thing, we feel bad, so we come back to church and we go, okay, God, really sorry. Take the piece of paper, forgiveness written on it, now we feel good about ourselves again. Until the next time it happens, then we go back to God again. And we take another piece of paper, forgiveness, thank you, God, very much. This makes faith meaningless, if that's what it's become to you. And actually, it's psychologically abusive, if that's what the church is actually saying and doing. It's a complete misunderstanding of what the gospel is about. There's a guy called John Piper, who I sat on his board for several years, and it's been a privilege for me to get to know him. I do warmly recommend his books. I don't know how many of you are familiar with him. If you are a Christian, then you do need to know that he is, without a shadow of doubt, the strongest Calvinist I've ever met in my whole life. But I don't blame him for that. God made him that way. He had no choice in the issue. Now, and he gives a very helpful analogy here. He says, look, so supposing my wife and I have had a fight. Now, sometimes my wife and I disagree. We've had more disagreements ever since she bought a laundry basket and put it in our bedroom. The theory is apparently that dirty laundry goes into the basket. Now, when I was at school, I was captain of the basketball team. I don't see a basket, I see a hoop. I like to stand on the other side of the bedroom and see how many points I can score. Some go in, straight, clean, three-pointers. Some are rebounders, 2 points. Some never make it. Sometimes they swerve to the left or the right. Sometimes the piece of clothing unfolds and gets stuck on the lampshade in the middle of the bedroom. So let's supposing I've been playing my favorite game. My wife walks into the room and says, oh, for goodness sake, why can't you just put your clothes in the basket? I'm tired. I'm grumpy. Neither of which are excuses. So I'm rude. Just tell her what she can do with the basket. She turns out and she walks out of the room. I follow her into the kitchen. You could cut the atmosphere with a knife. It's almost tangible. John Piper says, what needs to happen here? Well, the answer is plain. She has to apologize. No, sorry. I have to apologize. I have to apologize. Why? So she'll make my favorite breakfast. So the children won't see us fighting. So there'll be good sex tonight. All of those things may come true, he says, but they are all deficient motives for wanting to be forgiven. The reason I want to be forgiven is I want the sweet fellowship with my wife back. She is the reason I want to be forgiven. We come to God to ask forgiveness, not to make us feel better about ourselves, so the guilty feelings will go away. We come to God to ask for forgiveness because we want to be in relationship with him. We want to stay with him. We want to worship him. We want to be in communion with him. We want to walk with him. That is the reason why. It's not some kind of huge psychological play about making us feel better about ourselves. That's not what it's meant. That's not what it's about. It's about being in relationship with him. Do you know him? Are you in relationship with him? Or are you using him just now? I'm making a very tough appeal. It doesn't get any harder than this. There are men in this room who are so caught up in pornography addiction that every time you do it, you feel so shameful, you feel so guilty. You come to God and you just ask for forgiveness. God, please forgive me. And you feel better about yourself until the next time it happens, and the next time, and then the next time. If you've been trapped in this cycle for more than a year, whether you're willing to admit it or not, you are actually addicted to this problem. you have a serious problem. You can't keep coming to God, asking him forgiveness to make you feel better about yourself so you feel less guilty. You need to come to him because you want to be with him. And that's why you need family. That's why you need accountability. That's why you need to help people when you're struggling and failing. Some of you need to respond to him this morning. Not simply because God is speaking to you about it and you're feeling guilty, but you simply feel convicted and you want to be back in relationship with him. Look, if you've been coming to everything this church does for the last couple of years and you're not growing spiritually, I can almost guarantee this is most likely to be your problem. God will set you free. There's going to have to be confession. And there's going to have to be some accountability built in to help you. There are kids here. And women here. There are grandfathers and grandmothers. You're either here because you don't know him, you want to find out, I'd be happy to pray with you because if you'd like to meet him. Or you're here because you're wrestling with something. 8 out of 10, it's moral, not intellectual. 2 out of 10 are intellectual, I'll grant you that. But this is why we come here, to restore relationship, so there can be forgiveness, so that we can be in communion with him, walk with him, fellowship with him. I'm going to invite Steve to come up. I meant to finish now. And I can't even remember whether we were meant to finish now or we were meant to finish 5 minutes ago so we could finish now. I would like to finish by saying two things and then we may have time to pray for people. One, I'll stay down here at the front until eventually I'm taken away and they turn the lights out on this building. If you want to ask me any questions, I'll be down here at the front. Two, if you need to come back into relationship with God, or you need to start that relationship, all relationship starts with communication, starts with talking, it starts with praying. I'll be here, Steve will be here, other people will be here, you're going to get some clarity. Come and pray with us. Whatever it is, don't miss out on everything that God has for you, especially in a world that seems to be so blind, whirling on its own axis. Find him, trust him. Your life will never be the same. You've listened very well. Thank you very much. And Steve, let me hand over to you.